Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff. I'll be with you for approximately the next hour. We got started a few minutes late this evening because we are trying to establish contact with tonight's guest, Mr. Jim Murray, and having a little bit of communication problems. So we hope to get him on board. Anyway, the show must go on, and having an entertainment background, I'm well aware of that, and I'm going to wing it. However, I can use this opportunity to invite you to call in, and I'm going to give some numbers out. These are not the usual numbers I give out on the show. You may want to grab a pencil and paper and jot some of these down. The toll-free number in the USA and Canada is area code 888-228-4494. And the toll-free number worldwide is area code 877-489-6350. And I'll give out one of the direct lines for those of you that want to try just getting straight through and avoiding maybe the congestion of the toll-free numbers. Area code 530-776-5154. I welcome your calls. And since we're without a guest, it opens up an opportunity to talk about a variety of different things. And so I may be all over the place, but I'm going to be addressing some issues which are kind of interesting little tidbits that have come out, some in the mainstream media, believe it or not. And, of course, there's always a spin to how these things are brought to our attention, and you wonder why. Those who listen to Evident Footprints or really any other show on BBS Radio know that we are not mainstream. And that's why we say if it's not mainstream, then it's on bbsradio.com, because we do talk about things that you will not hear as propaganda on the mainstream. You will not hear the spin that they want people to focus their attention on while we have these crazy games going on in the background. And this is not just opinion. Much of what you will hear on this show from myself as well as from my guests usually bears out a lot of research, a lot of expertise, a lot of reading, a lot of study, and a lot of communication with others of like mind. And if you consider yourself to be outside the box, or at least attempting to get outside the box and outside of the matrix that they have created for you, then We suggest that you do some research. Go to the library, check out some books. You certainly can see some really good books on my website. And as time goes on and we have more authors on the show, we will continue adding books to my website. That's a service that I just give to these authors to give you a chance to find their materials. If you find their interviews interesting, if you find their information enlightening, and you want to further study their research, by all means, go to my website, directlightproductions.com, and just click on the link at the top of the page where it says books. It'll take you to the books page. You can click on any of the titles on that page, and it'll take you to a separate page and give you instructions on how to get to the author's material. You don't find that on a lot of websites these days. They usually take you directly to Amazon.com or eBay or some other clandestine place where you really can't find out anything about the author or about the material. I don't make money promoting their books, but you learn the truth, and that's why I do such a thing. So that's a service that I provide to some of my guests and to you in the hopes that if you are earnest about learning what is going on behind the scenes and want to understand why things are so chaotic and insane around the planet, then you will find some answers. And there's a variety of issues that are covered in these books, anything from 9/11 to bacteriological warfare, issues with the oil companies, and as well as certain types of technology or certain types of healing, medicine. There's a good variety of stuff. Some is politically oriented or historical. Some really revealing books. One particular gentleman that I'm going to have on the show again was responsible for giving me some tips and some photographs that I incorporated into my own research and my own journalistic work. Eric O'Ryan, who is at thebushconnection.com. Very interesting story that he wrote, and it's quite inflammatory. He has reason to be inflamed because when he contacted the Justice Department about the fact that many of the Nazis, we were told, were either executed or had died, were right here in the United States working undercover in mind control programs and with intelligence agencies. And they tried to kill him. So he wrote a book about it, and it's quite fascinating, at least to look at the photographs, if not to read some of the information that former Hitler bodyguard Otto Skorzeny gave him. So that's just one example. Dr. Larry Wayne Harris has been on the show, and he's talked about and written about bacteriological warfare planned by the UN and secret governments, and he himself is a scientist and came right out and shared this information with the listening audience on Evident Footprints. We may have him back again soon, too, just to bring this back into the public consciousness that we must be aware and prepared. This isn't about fear-mongering like they do to you on the mainstream media, whether it's TV, radio, newspapers, magazines, and the like. And we've had experts like G. Edward Griffin on the show, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's the true story about how they worked the scam called the Federal Reserve into our law and basically sold out our country. If you're concerned about what's happening in the country, you should know about these things. You don't have to take what I say as the gospel truth. Do some research. And we've got some great shows coming up in the coming weeks. We are going to have Pastor Matthew Stephen on again Tuesday, May the 20th. And he's going to be telling us more about some of the visions that he's had, prophetic visions, and some of the work that he's doing. And I would like to talk about some of those topics. With all this insanity, where do we go? What can we do? How can we extricate or even create something new? That's really our salvation, because we're looking at a broken wheel. Instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, let's try something other than a wheel. And it could be a wing. It could be, if you want to use the term, a magic carpet. It could be something different from what they have taught us. And this show, as well as many of the guests, are about empowerment. Self-empowerment is important and crucial to you being able to move on and network with other people of like mind. Certainly, you don't want to be around a bunch of criminals, because you know they're going to eventually take everything you have and possibly even kill you. So you're going to want to be close to people that can help you, or people that you can help. Many of you have talents. Many of you have gifts and abilities that can be of service to other people. And of course, one of the recurring messages that we have is that the concept of turning back to God and telling God that you are seeking His mercy and you are apologizing for your ignorance and for your apathy and for the things that you haven't done. And I'm not being judgmental in saying that. You know how you feel about those things yourself, and that's between you and God. But God is looking for us to turn back to Him and repenting against or repenting for our sins. The sins that we have committed are nothing more than acts devoid of love and kindness and consideration. And we've been taught that. It's been drilled into us nonstop. And, of course, our government is not exercising that. Our government's going around the world creating wars and fomenting new wars. Now, that's just a fact. That's not an opinion. You can see it on TV. You can read about it in the newspaper. But the reasons why they're conducting these wars are what they're not telling the masses, the majority of the people. And hearing from Jim Murray. So I'm going to pause for 1 second. Seth, if you're paying attention, we're going to try to get Jim on the line here. Maybe you can fill in some sound here.
Hi, this is Mark Omey, and you're listening to my song, Arabica, from my album, River of Soul. I would like to invite you to my website at marcome.com. You are now listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com, the number one internet radio network on the planet. Enjoy!
I apologize for that short break, that pause there, unexpected. We are getting through to our guest. So anyway, while we're getting the audio level set and everything, I just want to encourage you to do some research and find out that these things are for real. Now, with our guest tonight, Jim Murray, we have a special topic lined up, and we decided we were going to talk about some technology. A couple of weeks ago, my special guest, Kent Adachi, and I talked about Brown's gas and some of the inventions and the whole process of the theory of Brown's gas. And we're going to get into this with a scientist tonight. Jim Murray is an author. He's an inventor. He is a lecturer and a teacher. And as I mentioned, a scientist extraordinaire, and he understands many types of sciences, not just one particular field. And he incorporates all of that into what he studies as well as what he teaches and lectures about. Jim, are you with us?
Finally, yes. Good evening.
Okay. Doug. Yeah, your phone was non-responsive.
Well, I apologize for that, but unfortunately, I don't have any control over it. I really don't understand what was wrong.
Yeah, well, if they pick up your voicemail before you get the ring, there's obviously something that's got to be tweaked on their end, I would say.
Obviously.
So, we're glad we were able to establish contact with you. Welcome to the show.
Have I missed much? How long have you been on?
Well, I've been on for about the last 14, 15 minutes, something like that. So I was just kind of touching on some of the topics on my website and letting people know that there were some books posted there and that we're encouraging folks to do some research, not to freak out, not to jump to conclusions either, you know, that we're speaking from a research background as well as an experiential background, and we want to open people's eyes to what's going on in the world. And I was about to go into the oil issue, and you called, so it's good timing. Now, as you know, the oil prices are skyrocketing again. Many places across the country are up to $4 a gallon of gasoline now, and it's making Lindsey Williams look like a prophet. When he was on the show a month and a half or 2 months ago, he described exactly what the oil companies are were going to do, what their plans were. These plans were laid out 30 years ago, and he spoke about that. He wrote a book, The Non-Oil Crisis, and he's been speaking regularly on internet radio, traveling around the world speaking as an expert, and he's been sounding the alarm. People somehow couldn't believe it, though. Now they're getting a taste of his message in real time. Now, we were going to talk about Brown's Gas tonight, and I really can't think of anyone better than you or Ken Adachi to tackle this subject, and I know that you're going to tell us about some inventions that are out there that are ways that people can get around this issue of these outrageous prices.
Well, that's for sure, and I thought that I would start off by just telling our listeners how I got involved with Professor Brown, and then from there jump into the more in-depth disclosures concerning his discoveries. But I would like to lead off with one comment which echoes what you've already said, Don. There was a gentleman that I met, as a matter of fact, in conjunction with my involvement with Professor Brown, and I will just refer to him as the Frenchman. He was a rather astute money character that had an office in the World Trade Center, of all places. And he personally told me, and this has got to have been, oh my gosh. Well, it was back around the time of me meeting Professor Brown, so it's at least 9, 10, 12 years ago. He told me personally that gas in the United States was going to at least be made equal to the $5 per gallon fee that they pay in Europe. And he said that with extreme confidence. So as you say, the plans have been laid long ago, and it's just a question of how quickly they decide to close the vise.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that being said, as you know, I've been involved in independent research in alternate energy fields since 1966. And one of the big things that's always plaguing every researcher, especially people that are independent, is money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was attempting to raise money to commercialize the Dynaflux alternator. And I went and attended a lecture that was being given in New York, in the Wall Street area, about high-yield investment programs. And the main speaker was this Frenchman that I referred to. And I really liked the guy. I thought he was a very unusual individual. And so I stayed after the lecture, and we had quite an exchange between us. And he told me that the circles he traveled in were very interested in alternate energy projects simply because of the fact that they knew what was coming. They knew about this oil problem. They knew about our need for additional electrical power. They knew about all these things and had already done studies and projections. And this guy was the person who actually told me about Professor Brown, because I hadn't heard of him. And he made a deal with me, more or less. It was a handshake type thing. He said if I helped him to find Professor Brown, then he would do his best to help me piggyback an investment into one of these trading programs and possibly wind up with enough money to complete my research. So I said, well, that's easy. I'll jump right on that. Well, as you may or may not know, researchers have a kind of a telephone relay system of their own, a grapevine, as it were. And I put the word out that I was looking for this guy, Professor Brown. And within just a few days, I got back information that he was residing in California and that he had recently come here from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted the man, and he was quite cordial. He invited me to come out to his laboratory in, I think it was, I can't think of the name of the town now, something like Desto, California. And I did. I flew out there and spent 2-3 days with him. And I was very impressed at the things he said and the laboratory that he had put together and various experiments that he showed me and all sorts of things of that nature. And I asked him point blank, after having seen the quality of his equipment and the complexity of the work, I said, how in the world did you get this funded? And he told me that he had been in the same straits as myself, looking for backing, looking for independent sources of finance. And somewhere along the line, he was introduced to people from China who invited him to actually come and do his research in China, and they would foot the bill for everything. And he spent 7 years in Mongolia, which is way out there, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and at a place called the Metallurgical Institute of Mongolia. And during that time, he not only completed his initial investigations, which are into the production of Brown's gas, but he then started to branch off into multiple applications for the use of this gas. And after I spent some time with him, I wrote a very lengthy report, and I submitted it to the Frenchman in New York. And within about a week, he got back to me, and he said, we are no longer interested in this man. And I said, well, since that leaves me out in the cold, I said, I would like to know why. And he said, because he has spent 7 years in China, and I can't explain to you exactly why, but that automatically precludes us from becoming involved with him. So I imagine that it was for some financial reasons, but at any rate, or political reasons.
I know what the answer to that is, if you would like to hear. Are you saying you don't know the reason, or?
No, I don't really know the reason. I drew some conclusions, but, you know, they weren't based on anything more than hunches.
Well,
so if you know, by all means, fill in the blanks.
They're using that technology in China, exclusively in China. They're using that technology. And
well, that I knew.
And it's forbidden anywhere else in the world. They will not allow that to encroach upon the oil cartel's massive profits and their obfuscation of the fact that they are intentionally raising prices and basically shutting down all the wells. There is no shortage of oil. There never was. It's all contrived. So, specifically, it's that China uses the Brown's gas technology that he developed, and it's been forbidden to be used anywhere else. Now, who are these people to tell us that we can't use something that benefits us? So,
well,
go ahead.
I don't know specifically who they are, but in my neighborhood, they wouldn't last very long.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim. I give it back to you.
So anyway, some time passed by, and I was eventually introduced to Dennis Lee, who I'm sure you've heard of. And he had a research thing going in New Jersey, and I was still living out there at that time. and he invited me to join his crowd with promises of funding my research work. And during, and I took him up on it, quite honestly. And during my association with Mr. Lee, we had fairly frequent powwows concerning who I knew, what I was doing, what I had done in the past, et cetera, et cetera. And I, in one of those conversations, I happened to mention that I had met Dr. Brown and seen his laboratory and was very impressed with what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Mr. Lee immediately said, well, we have to get him on board here. And so because of his show of interest, I gave him Professor Brown's phone number, and he called him up and made all sorts of overtures to him on the phone, and he was declined. And so he said to me, you and I are going to California, and I'm not coming back without a contract from Professor Brown. So I said, okay. So we flew to California, and I never saw a sale in my life made like this one, I have to tell you. It was pretty impressive. We both traveled light. I had one little handheld carry-on suitcase, and Dennis had something similar. And we got to this town in California, went right to the hotel where we met Professor Brown, and Dennis invited him up to the room. And the minute that we got him inside and closed the door, Dennis sat down, he opened his bag, and he took two mysterious black cylinders out of his bag. They were made of plastic, and he put them on the tabletop, and he said to Professor Brown, now, he says, I know you've been given the runaround many times, he says, but I am here to tell you that I am greatly appreciative of your talents, your knowledge, and your work, and I want to work with you, and I'm going to prove my sincerity. And he unscrewed the ends of these cylinders and poured out onto the table $20,000 in gold cougarons. And
okay.
So Professor Brown looked at him, you know, with an astonished look, and he says, and what am I supposed to do to avail myself of this wealth? And he said, nothing. It's yours to keep. So we chatted for about 4 hours straight, went out and had dinner that night, and we flew back to New Jersey the next morning. And as God is my witness, by the time we got back to Dennis's headquarters in New Jersey, there was a long 10-page contract scrolling out of the fax machine onto the office floor. And so he wound up getting the attention and the cooperation of Dr. Brown, Professor Brown. So Brown moved to New Jersey and joined a little complex there, and we began doing some very interesting work. And he was involved with that organization for about 2 years. And then they eventually had a falling out, and Brown went back to Australia and wound up dying down there.
Oh, that's too bad.
But anyway, in the time that I knew him, we investigated powering automobile engines with this stuff, neutralizing radiation, making atmospheric engines, which is a really interesting concept that I'm still flabbergasted about. New types of pumping equipment, turbines, and just all sorts of things that you just normally don't have exposure to. Dennis then went around the country on one of his mega tours and exhibited some of these findings all across the United States and raised the hopes of a lot of people that this technology was near at hand. But the fact of the matter is, in order to make it commercially viable is going to take a great deal of additional work and a lot of money. So I'm not sure where that's going to leave us. But with that introduction under my belt, unless you have some questions, I will go on to describe what Brown's gas is, what it can be used for, and what we did with it.
Well, there are some questions, but maybe it's appropriate to ask them as you get going. I was wondering if you got an offer for another 20,000 Krugerrands yourself, but
no, actually, I wasn't offered a whole lot by Mr. Lee, but I valued the association because it allowed me to work with some really unusual individuals, and I think the best of the bunch was Professor Brown. The guy was really unusual and very bright and not well understood.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that he told me personally, and I mean, we had actually started to get pretty close. It's just a shame that the association with Mr. Lee wound up souring that. But what he told me was a pretty amazing story. Apparently, you know, he was from Bulgaria. And initially, he had gone into an order of monks. I don't remember what one it was. He did mention it. And he was in a monastery for quite a few years, contemplating his spiritual development. And he did a lot of reading and a lot of translating and other things of that sort. And during that time period, he came across some really ancient manuscripts on alchemy. And one of these manuscripts talked about the fact that water could be burned. And I don't know just how much information it gave regarding the details for this, but that was the stimulus, nonetheless, that that started Professor Brown off on his career. And he escaped from Bulgaria, because it was still behind the Iron Curtain at that time, and wound up in a slave camp somewhere and had all sorts of misadventures, and finally got to Australia, where he put together his first company and began making these Brown's gas generators. Now, before I get into all of that, it might be appropriate to talk about what Brown's gas is.
Sure.
Or at least what it appears to be.
Mm-hmm.
As you probably know, ordinary water is a compound consisting of hydrogen and oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And the famous formula H2O gives you insight into the molecular structure of the compound, that there are, of course, two atoms of hydrogen bonded to one atom of oxygen, and that gives us the substance we know as water.
Mm-hmm.
And the bonding that joins the hydrogen to the oxygen, I believe, if I remember correctly, creates an angle of 108 degrees between the two hydrogen atoms. And that causes water to be slightly polarized, which allows it to participate in lots of unusual reactions, and even milder things like allowing you to dissolve sugar in it or other substances that respond to this ionic activity once they are in solution. But anyway, to make hydrogen gas, which is used a lot in industry and, of course, nowadays is being contemplated as a fuel. There are a number of chemical ways of doing it, but one of the simplest ways is to use direct current electricity through a special chamber and avail yourself of the process known as electrolysis,
mm-hmm.
which literally uses electrical forces to pull these molecules apart, thereby releasing hydrogen at one pole and oxygen at the other. And now, these some of these electrolysis chambers that are used to generate these gases, especially the ones that are demonstrated in college and university level, are two glass tubes that are shaped kind of like the letter H. And they've got the electrodes at the bottom of each of the risers, and they've got a spigot at the top of each of the risers so that you can withdraw the gas. And at the crossbar of the H, they have a semi-permeable membrane which allows the electrons and the positive ions to migrate back and forth from one electrode to the other, but prevents, you know, any of the other materials from getting from the right side to the left side. And when the current is turned on, and these columns are filled with water, they slowly begin to disintegrate into hydrogen and oxygen. And you can actually watch them. These things can be calibrated, and you can actually watch the gas evolve and slowly fill the chambers. And naturally, the hydrogen side displaces water at twice the rate as the oxygen side, which is completely understandable. And because of the design of this thing, you can draw off hydrogen separately from the oxygen. Now, I have to point out to you that the chemical mixture of hydrogen and oxygen is considered to be an extremely volatile combination and is greatly feared. And so when these experiments are done, it's always done with the utmost of care to make sure that there's no way that the hydrogen gas on one side of this H column can get to the oxygen gas on the other side. And as a result of that paranoia, when people found out that Brown was deliberately mixing these gases upon their release from the electrolyzed water, there was an immediate stigma that was generated on this whole issue, and the resulting paranoia was unbelievable. It didn't matter whether the thing worked or not. That was never considered. The only thing that I actually witnessed this myself, the only thing that drove these so-called open-minded scientists was the fact that they heard the words hydrogen-oxygen mixture, and they went berserk. I was personally involved in a couple of instances where we had gone to universities to try to get this gas analyzed in a spectrometer, and the minute that they heard that it was a mixture and that these two gases were not separated but were actually encouraged to evolve in the same chamber, there was literally panic. One idiot actually pushed the fire alarm on the building and evacuated the whole place. We were carrying this small Brown's gas generator, which produced about 500 liters per hour, something like that. And they just couldn't fathom the whole concept.
Is that because they had been brainwashed into thinking that there might be an explosion or something along those lines?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, it was really remarkable. A lot of the people we mentioned this to, you know, stood up, became absolutely rigid, and said, "Remember the Hindenburg." And, of course, there's no comparison, but it doesn't make any difference. That's what's implanted in their brains.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter that they had working hardware, which was completely safe. It didn't matter about the results, and it most assuredly didn't matter about the scientific knowledge that might be forthcoming from studying this gas and this process in detail. Never happened. I was so frustrated with the whole thing that I was astonished when a friend of mine from a university in Cincinnati actually managed to get us into a spectroscopy lab where we were lucky enough to put a sample through one of the machines there, a gas spectrometer. And the results were absolutely mind-boggling, Don, because what got printed out was that this gas was nothing more than water. And the only difference between a normal printout of water that you get from the tap and this Brown's gas stuff was the fact that there was a phase shift in the molecular arrangement, but it was still water. And I had asked Dr. Brown about that, and what he had told me was that when you release hydrogen and oxygen together in the same chamber, rather than keeping them separated, as the atoms of hydrogen and oxygen are released from the water, in their nascent state, they are monatomic, which means they haven't linked up with anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially individual atoms. And a very high percentage of these will migrate toward one another and combine to form a completely different arrangement of water. So he used to call it HHO. And he said that the difference was twofold. The molecular bonding was spread to its maximum extent, which was about 180 degrees. And the molecules of this new water, if you will, were gigantic in size compared to the normal size water molecules, because that bond spreading allowed them, you know, the structure to expand. And this is the kind of thing that was showing up on the printout from this university's equipment, and nobody knew how to interpret it. But the thing that's the most fascinating about Brown's gas for me is that when you produce it properly and in a confined space so that it doesn't mix with any ordinary air or other gases, you can literally pass a spark through it and cause an enormous chain reaction which will rush down through the entire volume of gas that's within the chamber you're working with. And the result is an instantaneous vacuum. It doesn't explode, it implodes. And that's an astonishing thing. But it's a fascinating thing because it really waylays all of the fear about this stuff blowing up under these conditions. I can tell you personally that I've worked with Brown's gas generators as large as 2,000 cubic meters per hour of this gas. And on several occasions, I've had the flame front back up into the machine simply because of the fact that the torch tip was dirty, or you know, something happened, that the wrong valve was turned off, you know, whatever. And the machine was just designed to be husky enough to withstand the compressional impulse that went along with the implosion. And less than 5 minutes later, you're back using the torch, cutting metal or whatever you're doing with absolutely no harm to anybody, including the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another one of those amazing examples of how brainwashed some of these so-called scientists are, that they're not even listening or interested in listening to the details or how wonderful a thing is. They're just driven by the notion that you can't have hydrogen and oxygen in the same chamber, which is unfortunate.
The electronic probes or the electronic wires that cause this separation of the hydrogen and oxygen, is there an electrical charge that remains within the hydrogen and or the oxygen molecules themselves, or is it something that just remains, let's say, at the area of the plate in the chamber? Do you know?
Well, the individual nascent atoms definitely have charges when they're released from the water matrix by the electric field.
Okay.
But the minute that they become airborne or you know, remove themselves from the confines of the liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Their valence charges are so strong that they immediately seek out, you know, an appropriate mate, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if some of them link up with other hydrogen atoms and some of the oxygens link up with other oxygen atoms, because there's always a few, you know, H2s and O2s floating around. That's the diatomic form of hydrogen or the diatomic form of oxygen. But the strange fact of the matter is that most of the atoms released under these conditions will link up with the opposite species. In other words, the hydrogen will link up with an oxygen in this new formation and give you this weird semi-ionic bond where the atoms are arranged 180 degrees apart. Now, I brought this to a friend of mine a few years back, who is not only a chemist but a physicist. And when we discussed this, and I told him about the bonding structure, he immediately, from his own mind, drew the crystal lattice that would be representative of such an arrangement. And he said, "My God," he said, "this stuff, this gas," he said, "would have the properties of a liquid insofar as it would be incompressible." In other words, it would mm-hmm. act like a hydraulic fluid.
Yes.
To some extent. And he said, "I can immediately see that if you disturbed the lattice that was forming, that the whole thing could crumble." And he said, "That's probably what happens when you send a spark through it and it becomes a vacuum." And he was very impressed with it. But he was the only one that was. That and the fellow who arranged for the spectroscopic analysis for me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let's get back to, and unless you have another question, let me just get back to the applications of this stuff that we...
I did have one question, and it's related to your comment about it changing phase, and you did sort of answer that when you said it was opposite, 180 degrees opposite. Had any measurements been made through a phase meter, let's say, where the charge might appear, and I'll just use this as a hypothetical example. Let's say if it had been wired to a phase meter, much like they do in audio work, where you're testing the waveforms of a left channel and a right channel speaker, would it invert to minus one at that point? Had that been done at all, or?
Well, the actual difference in phase, as it was called, showed up on the printout from the meter, from the gas spectrometer, and the way it was done was that when the chamber is first prepared for sample, they deliberately introduce standard water vapor to give you a background to printout or a relative zero, if you will, for the experiment. And mm-hmm. then once that has been established, then they introduce the Brown's gas and, you know, activated the device again. And the printout was identical except for the fact that there was an obvious phase shift between the position of the hydrogen and oxygen bonds. There mm-hmm. was about 70 to 72 degrees off from the standard, which makes a lot of sense, because if you're going from an ordinary bond structure of 108 degrees to 180 degrees, you would expect to see a 72-degree phase shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason I asked that question basically is because if there is an electrical charge, there could also be a parallel use for that charge in producing electricity.
Well, it was interesting you should mention that, because one of the things I did discuss with Professor Brown was how could Brown's gas be used to generate electricity directly. And, you know, had he ever given any thought to the possibility of putting it into some kind of a fuel cell?
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, most fuel cells that are built around the idea of electrodes separated by a semipermeable membrane and then have your hydrogen introduced on one side and oxygen introduced on the other, and as they bond together, water dribbles out the bottom and electricity is available at the positive and negative plates of these electrodes. And I couldn't envision how you would be able to do that if you already had the hydrogen and oxygen bonded together. But he insisted that there was a way, and frankly, I never figured that one out. What we did work with, though, was the enormous power of this instantaneous vacuum. And I, to this very day, I'm impressed with what we did there. I built an engine based on this concept that was essentially an atmospheric engine. And the reason I use that term is because the pistons were open to the air, and they were actually pressed down and turned the crankshaft as a result of the weight of the atmosphere. So the air itself was the fuel, if you want to use that term.
Mm-hmm.
But the chamber was prepared for receiving the air by closing the valve and flooding it with Brown's gas, and then once the Brown's gas was in place, what happened was you put a spark through it, and it implodes and creates a huge vacuum, and then the minute that the vacuum is established on one side, the valve is opened on the other side, and the atmosphere naturally shoves the piston towards the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a internal combustion engine in reverse. Instead of having, the air as being part of the reaction and then getting a foul chemical compound as an exhaust, the atmosphere provides the actual, thrust that drives the cylinder, and the purpose of the Brown's gas is twofold. It expands into the cylinder after each ignition, pushes the piston back against the air pressure, and then once it's occupying that position, it's just touched off and recreates the vacuum. So it's a very, very interesting system. And
now, did it tax the engine in a different way at all, or did it make the operation of the engine seem more effortless?
Well, it was very effortless because nobody was doing anything. I mean, it's not like there's no explosion type of thing involved. But the one thing that was interesting was with just by changing the volume of the Brown's gas, you can automatically change the amount of horsepower that you got out of the thing because you would then appropriately enlarge the surface area of the piston.
Mm-hmm.
And the atmospheric pressure is automatically 14.7 pounds per square inch. So once you get to a fairly large piston, you know, it's very easy to create hundreds of pounds or even thousands of pounds of force. As a matter of fact, we had a demo that we used to do on stage, with this arrangement, where we had one great big cylinder, and the piston from the cylinder would be extended all the way down, the Brown's gas introduced behind it, and then ignited, and that would create the vacuum. And then we would pick someone from the audience who looked like they were very heavy, or big boned, or whatever you want to use, term you want to use. And they come up on stage and sit on a device similar to a swing. And the top of this was then anchored to the piston. And when you open the valve to the atmosphere, it would just pick them up effortlessly.
Hmm.
You know, and if you open the valve real suddenly, they'd go for a heck of an interesting ride, although it would only be, you know, about 8 or 10 inches of displacement.
Uh-huh.
But the force was considerable. Now, the interesting thing, Don, the exhaust from this type of engine is, strictly speaking, water vapor. So it's not polluting in any way, shape, or form.
And, of course, it didn't do any harm to the metals in the engine or the exhaust system or anything like that either, did it?
Well, to be honest with you, I can't answer that question, you know, completely, because we never had the thing running long enough or the money to then go back and have, you know, the structure tear it apart and analyze to see if there were any changes. But what I can tell you was, in the short period of time that we've messed with it, I didn't detect anything. Although we did find strange things happening in that one cylinder device that was used on the stage, because after a while the water had to be replaced. It did change chemically into something very foreign.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was unfortunate. It was never analyzed.
Now, but, did the engine experience any heat, changes, differences in heat, let's say like running cooler as opposed to getting hot, or did it...
Well, of course, you have to understand that we didn't run them at very high speed because, you know, the budget we were working with didn't allow for a huge piston,
mm-hmm.
which the mathematics would have suggested was the way to do this. So it was a very slow running system, but there was an interesting side effect. Once the chamber had been purged and the Brown's gas introduced, and then the valve locked down, when the ignition spark was fired, there was an impulse that you could hear. It sounded just like a chime ringing.
Hmm.
It was really fascinating. And what it was, we all came to this conclusion that the vacuum was created so suddenly that the change in pressure with the cylinder going from being in a state of equilibrium to going to supporting a vacuum, the impulse of that shock with the atmosphere suddenly hammering against the side of the piston gave a metallic ring, and it had a certain tone to it depending on how big the piston was. So
yeah,
the thing was almost musical when it was running. It was very interesting.
Yeah, that would be just a harmonic resonance from the percussion of the initial thrust, in other words.
Yeah, very interesting thing. Now, the other thing we did, which was quite cool, too, Brown's gas, when it's in a pure state, will only implode. And you can put it into a torch, and you can cut with it beautifully, just like an oxyacetylene torch or an oxyhydrogen torch. But the difference is that you're producing this flame by burning water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fantastically colored flame. I mean, when it first starts burning, it's a pumpkin color. And then as the reaction continues and the system is purged, it becomes almost invisible. And when you look at it, you can see, if you look at it closely, a cone-shaped flame. And inside the cone are these little blue V's. And I pointed that out to this friend of mine who is a PhD in physical chemistry and got us into the lab there to have the analysis done. And he said, you know, he said, that's the same type of signature that you see coming out of the exhaust of a jet plane. And it signifies the fact that gas is moving, you know, at supersonic speeds, you know, within the confines of that envelope. So
mm-hmm.
even though the pressure isn't very high, the flame front is moving at an unbelievable velocity. And the thing that was, here's one of the most amazing things about burning that stuff as a flame. You can literally put your fingers in it, and as long as you don't keep them stationary, there's no problem. You won't be burned or anything. You'll feel mild warmth. Now, anybody that's ever done any cutting or welding knows you can't run your fingers through an oxyacetylene flame and make the same comment, because you'll be looking at scorched flesh. The interesting thing is that the atmospheric or ambient temperature of Brown's gas burning as a flame is 212 degrees. And so the next question people say is, well, how can you cut steel with a flame that's 212 degrees? That's the thermal signature of boiling water. Everybody knows that the pot doesn't melt when you boil water in it, so how can you cut steel with this? Well, here's the thing that's interesting. We did experiments with a number of different targets, and we found that all you have to do is change the flame from one material to another, and the temperature changes. Now, since the flame is not in any way changed, you know, the most common sense explanation comes from the fact that there is a nuclear effect going on in each of the different materials. You can go, for instance, from cutting steel and then whip over, it's about 3,000 degrees or 2,800 degrees to cut steel, and then whip over to another target made of tungsten. Tungsten needs an excess of 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, as I recall, and instantly it'll vaporize. And then you can even go to something that would normally be considered benign, like a field boulder or a piece of brick from a building. And you can just puddle that in a matter of minutes or seconds, depending on how big your flame is. And to melt rock into a glass takes a heck of a lot of temperature. But this is a kind of temperature variation that you could get with that flame just by switching targets. And I do know from talking to Dr. Brown that one of the things that the Chinese were experimenting with was feeding various types of high atomic weight materials that have been formed into a wire into the flame, and then measuring the liberated energy from that. And once you found the right combination of elements to put into that flame, the energy that was released was hundreds of times greater than the electrical power that was being consumed to create the gas. And so they were already, 12, 13 years ago, they were already investigating methods of using this for generating a gain in power, between what it took to make the gas versus what you could get out of a system thermally. And one of the other products that Professor Brown had worked on and was widely accepted in China was the maritime fleet had adopted his method of desalinization of salt water aboard their merchant marine vessels to provide drinking water. And it was a complete Brown's gas system, Don. And essentially it worked by introducing seawater into a large chamber, purging the air out of the chamber with Brown's gas, closing the valve on both sides, and then igniting the gas, which immediately it put the water in an environment of a vacuum. And anybody that's ever put a cup of water under a bell jar and started the vacuum pump will know that it immediately boils, because the definition of boiling is simply to bring the vapor pressure of the liquid equal to the atmospheric pressure. And if you reduce the atmospheric pressure, you induce boiling. So here they boil this water in this chamber with practically no need for heat at all. There was a small coil brought in from a source of hot water from the engines on the ship just to supply heat of vaporization, because if you don't do that, the water will boil and freeze at the same time, which is a very interesting experiment to try, by the way. It looks very bizarre. But once you have a heat of vaporization supply from an external source, that water just immediately boils away, leaving a residue of salt. And they condense the fumes that are drawn off that chamber, and they have pure drinking water. And we tried to introduce that method in this country. Nobody could care less. They're just going to go ahead and do it the way they always do it. Meantime, in China, every respectable ship that's afloat has already embraced this system. And that was many years ago.
Yeah, my understanding is, and I would guess the reason for this would be so they don't have to raise the base salaries, you know, minimum wage, if you want to call it that, what they pay their workers. They wouldn't have to raise it if they could afford cheap fuel, and so they could maintain a control over their people and still give them this technology, which is going to save them money as a government in the long run, and at the same time make us pay for it by raising our prices. And that's exactly what's going on. So you can presume that anything that's going to cause the oil cartel to lose money is going to be suppressed. Do you know if our government is using this at all in military applications or even in space? Have you heard anything about that?
No, not lately, but when Professor Brown was still alive, one of the things that he was extremely keen on was the fact that he had experimented with using this flame from one of his Brown's gas torches to reduce radioactive material to safe levels. And he was very, very interested in setting up a commercial plant to do this. And, of course, that brought the hammers of hell against him because now he was interfering with a really privileged industry that didn't want any kind of new innovations of any sort unless it had originated inside. But he did give demonstrations of this to closed audiences. And, I mean, he was a little bit nuts. I mean, he used to carry radioisotopes in his pocket. And then he would take them out and put them on a special plate and melt them with the torch and then treat the melted material with this flame. And once they measured the radiation before and afterward, and if I remember correctly, the change was enormous. It was either 65% reduction or 80% reduction, you know, something like that, a very big number. It didn't get rid of it completely, but, I mean, it was an enormous change. And the mechanism behind this, although I never proved this to my own satisfaction, was hypothecated by those who saw it to mean that the gas somehow either contained or released from its target material a very profound neutron flux. Because, you know, in order to be able to take a radioisotope, which is so many rads per hour radioactive, and make it almost benign, the only way that can ever happen, in my opinion, is if the material is transmuted into something else. And as far as we know, with the exception of certain things that are done in alchemy, but in normal nuclear physics, as far as I know, the greatest agency to promote transmutation of elements is an intense neutron flux. And so, you know, this is one of the earlier attempts to transmute under controlled conditions laboratory samples by using various types of particle accelerators.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a guy doing it with a flame that doesn't hardly cost anything to produce. Well, you know, when you have stellarators and lineacs and cyclotrons and cosmotrons that cost billions of dollars, and they're not getting anywhere with this, and some yo-yo comes along with a new blowtorch and says, here, I'll show you how to do it. that doesn't go down too well in the halls of academia.
or the military-industrial complex, for that matter.
Yeah, well, that's for sure.
That's a given.
So anyway, needless to say, nobody bothered to follow up on it, as far as I know. But that doesn't mean that things aren't going on behind closed doors. Who knows?
Yeah, well, this is certainly something we could revisit on another show if you have anything to add to it. We are out of time, though, and I want to thank you for checking in with us. We had tried a number of times to be, get you passed into the board tonight. It just wasn't working, so you might want to give your phone company a bit of your mind. Maybe they need some brown gas.
I would definitely give them a neighborly call on Monday.
Okay. Anyway, Jim, it's been a pleasure, very educational and enlightening, and I'm sure our listening audience will find the same thing. You're going to be with us again next week, provided you have a phone carrier, I guess. So I look forward to that, and want to thank you for hanging in there and appearing on the show. And we're going to give the audience a good night here. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, and our special guest every Friday night is scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray, and he's also our good friend. We want to thank Seth Hendrick for sound tonight and for making the connection work tonight. Also thank Don Newsom for making this show possible. And just a heads up, got a very interesting article entitled The Three Stooges Go to Washington, coming out in the Idaho Observer next week. Do yourself a favor, go to idaho-observer.com and sign up for a subscription to the paper. It's a monthly paper, a very nominal fee, worth every penny. And you can also go to my website, directlightproductions.com, read some past articles that I have there. These are along the same lines, pretty mind-blowing in the context of what's going on in this presidential election. You are certain to be enthralled with what you learn. In the meantime, I want to wish everyone a great weekend and a very peaceful, love-filled, light-filled night and a good night.
Of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.